This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour, everyone. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. And this is the part of the program which we call the big picture. And I know last week, Jim, you did your annual investment strategy seminar in San Diego, which was well attended. So we thought we would discuss some of the themes that came up during that conference. And I know the overall theme was called Approaching the Peak. And what does that mean? What are we approaching and how are you framing the whole seminar?
Well, anytime we put on a conference, we always try to pick a theme that we think is going to dominate the markets in the economy in the year ahead. And, you know, some of the things we've covered in the past, as listeners might have guessed, in 2012, our theme was don't fight the Fed. 2013, our theme was there are more things that are right than wrong in the economy. 2014 was stay in our backyard because the U.S. had the best looking economy in a global neighborhood. And last year, we were saying prepare for the final phase of the bull market. This year, John, the theme is approaching the peak. We think we've approached the peak in economic activity and also in this market cycle. Now, some of the technicians we have on the program think that, you know, there's still some momentum left in this market. But what we're watching, and we'll get into this in our second topic, which is a look at the business cycle and where we stand. But, you know, if you take a look at where we've been since the new millennium began, it's unlike, I don't know, John, with you, it's unlike anything I've experienced in my lifetime. I mean, we began the millennium with the idea that we were entering a new economy. We would be prosperous. We were all going to get rich. You know, the stock market was going up 15% a year. But what happened is we began the millennium with a recession and the bursting of the tech bubble. That was followed by the events of 9/11, the second Gulf War, and now the war on terrorism. And then we went through an oil shock. We had, beginning in 2005, we had two hurricanes wipe out basically an American city and one-third of the oil production in the Gulf of Mexico. So from 2005 to 2008, oil prices went from 50 to 150, something we had never even seen before. But I think what is concerning to a lot of investors, listeners to this show, and even people in the industry, is ever since the Great Recession, what we've seen is massive stimulus that has been unable to achieve any liftoff in the economy. And everybody keeps talking about the great moderation, and economists are saying, you know, once we get through this, we get this stimulus, we'll get back to 3% economic growth. But John, how many times have you and I talked about the Fed in its basically its economic projections, which have been wrong about 95% of the time, including 2016? Here we are in November. The Fed just did a pass, although the futures market are saying they probably go in December. But we began this year with four rate hikes and 3% economic growth. And here we are with economic growth that'll fall below 2% this year and maybe only one rate hike.
Well, if we flash back to the 1980s and 90s, in reality, things then were relatively stable. I mean, the stock market went up. The economy grew during that time, and there were long periods of time when we really didn't have anything resembling a recession. So what created the environment where all of that could happen?
Well, I mean, we began the 1980s coming off the 70s where we had stagflation, double-digit inflation. We had a very aggressive Federal Reserve under Paul Volcker. And then you got to remember, Ronald Reagan's policy came in with deregulating the economy. When Reagan took office, tax rates were 70%. When Reagan left office, they were 28%. So lower regulation, more freer markets, and also lower taxation. But there were a couple other things that were occurring during that period of time that made the Great Moderation as stable as it was for nearly 25 years. You know, I guess the theory behind the Great Moderation is that central banks and governments had tamed the business cycle because we had two back-to-back recessions in 79 and 81, but then we would go 10 years in between a recession. We had a recession in 81. We did not have another one until 1991, and it was a mild one. And then the next recession was 2001. And so all the variables of the economy seemed to moderate. It was less volatile. And it was attributed to that, well, central banks were freed of, let's say, political interference as they were in the 70s under Nixon and then Carter and Ford. But there was something else that was really going on that I think economists didn't pick up on that eventually gave us what we call the Great Recession. Because what if you really look back, total debt in the United States was about $5 trillion in 1980. By the time we got to the Great Recession and where we are today, total debt, this is non-financial debt, went to $46 trillion. So, John, during this period of time, there was a tenfold increase in debt. There were other subtle things that were also changing in the economy. This was a time when the U.S. went from a manufacturing-based economy as multinational corporations moved and closed down factories here, moved them overseas. It's amazing. Now that's one of the big issues in this political campaign, especially with Donald Trump. And we also went more to a financial economy. And as debt was growing in the U.S. economy, all that debt, didn't matter if it was mortgage on your home, if it was a car loan or even credit cards, got packaged and put into securities and were sold as investment products. So all of this debt that we were creating, we created this financial aspect of the economy as finance became a larger and larger percentage of the U.S. economy. And the best example I could give you is the transformation of General Electric, the largest industrial company in the United States. By the time we got to the 90s, General Electric got most of its revenues from financing, GE Finance. General Electric was using financial derivatives to create its earnings because no industrial company grows its earnings every single quarter at 14% a year. And that's what was occurring with General Electric during the 90s. A lot of companies got most of their revenues from the finance arm rather than they did the production arm. So the U.S. economy was basically changing, and debt was growing at all levels. It was growing at the consumer level. Consumer debt went up enormously. Savings rates, it's hard to believe that the savings rate in this country was at 10 and 12% in 1980 and got down to zero at the beginning of the last decade. I mean, why save when the stock market was going up 15 to 20% as it did the last 5 years in the 90s? It was corporate debt was growing and government debt. I mean, if you think about it, we've talked about this on the program over the years. George Bush came in with the total government debt of $5 trillion. He doubled it to $10 trillion. Barack Obama comes in 2008. When he leaves office in January, he will have doubled the national debt to $20 trillion. So much of what happened in the economy was being driven by debt. It was being driven by a financial economy. They call it the FIRE economy, finance, insurance, and real estate. So what the U.S. was doing was creating all this debt and then pyramiding on this debt with the growth of derivatives that grew exponentially during that period of time. In Wall Street, including the Treasury under Clinton, were fighting the regulation of derivatives that when they fought Brooksley Bourne, when she came in and basically said, look, these are very dangerous instruments. We need to put them on some kind of exchange where they're regulated. That was fought by Summers, Rubin, and by Greenspan. So a lot of these derivatives eventually led and created part of the financial crisis that was so severe between 2007 and 2009 when we had companies like AIG with credit default swaps, Merrill Lynch. All these companies, Bear Stearns, that went under because of these financial products of leverage. So, John, the Great Moderation was not really created as some people think. What drove a lot of the Great Moderation was the expansion of debt in the financialization of the U.S. economy.
Well, we had the Great Recession, but at one point you get this image that debt is moderating. But if you look at where we are right now, that wouldn't seem to be true. And I guess the real question is this just a U.S. phenomenon or is this something more global affecting other central banks and countries?
It's global. I mean, total outstanding debt globally was $57 trillion in the year 2000. By the time we got to 2007, it had grown to $142 trillion. Today, it's over $200 trillion. Household debt has cut down in terms of its growth rate. It's down to about 5% a year. It used to be growing at 7% a year. Corporate debt has slowed down. Government debt has been moderating. It's been fairly consistent, growing at about 6% a year. But where the big growth in debt has been is the financial industry. Since the Great Recession, financial debt in the economy is somewhere around $15 trillion in the U.S., and that's been growing at over 9% a year since the Great Recession. So the problem that we have with the Great Moderation, it was really, in retrospect, driven by the expansion of debt, which fueled the fire economy, and that built and pyramided a system of leverage in the financial system, and we had a whole new industry open up on Wall Street, which was financial products selling to the public. Basically, all that debt in all its forms, car loans, home loans, credit card loans, was now being sold and packaged as investments, sold here and then sold globally.
Okay, so that was the Great Moderation, but since we came through the crisis, the buzzword became the new normal. But if we look today, that would even seem to be a misnomer because nothing seems normal right now.
No. And part of it is we're going through this deleveraging process. And anytime you do that, what government is trying to do is it has expanded its balance sheet. As I mentioned, Barack Obama will add $10 trillion to the national debt. But fortunately for government, we have something called financial repression, where government policies through the central bank are suppressing the rate of interest. So the government pays less in interest expense today than they did back in 2008 when there was $10 trillion less in debt. And so you have this subpar economic growth, but the problem is after the disaster of the Obama stimulus, which basically was just transfer payments. There weren't shovel-ready projects. So what has driven economic growth and driven the financial markets have been central banks. And there was a book written by Mohammed El-Erian, formerly with PIMCO, and his book is called The Only Game in Town. And John, you know, what do we do on this show? We spend almost half of our time outside talking about fundamentals, talking about what central banks are going to do. What is the Fed going to do? Will the Fed now raise interest rates in December? They just had a meeting this week where they clarified, they said they're building the case for further rate hikes. So now the futures market is banking on a 70% probability that the Fed will finally raise interest rates in December. It's taken them a whole year to do that. But it's not just the Fed. We talk about the European Central Bank, about quantitative easing, the Bank of Japan, the Bank of China, the Bank of England just cut interest rates. So what is really incredible and what has been confusing for Wall Street economists, government economists, and the Federal Reserve economists is you think of the amount of stimulus that has been applied to the economy, and we can't even get beyond 2% economic growth. Today, we're cruising more in the 1% range for this year. We'll be below 2%. And when you think about the government has added $10 trillion of deficit spending, call that stimulus. The Fed's balance sheet has expanded by over $4 trillion. Globally, central banks have expanded their balance sheets by over $16 trillion. I mean, that's a lot of stimulus, and we are now looking at the lowest interest rates in recorded human history. Literally, the great investment strategist Sidney Homer wrote a book on a history of interest rates, and he's got a graph in there, and we've updated that, going back to the time of Hammurabi. And John, there's only two times in history we had interest rates that spiked like they did in, let's say, the 70s. You would have to go back to 3000 BC to see interest rates anywhere close to where we got in the 70s. The norm throughout history has been around 3 to 4%, 3 to 5% on interest rate on government bonds. Pretty much, if you take a look at Fed rate raising cycles, they would raise the Fed funds rate to 6 or 7%. Then we would get in a recession. They would lower it to 3%. If you look at the Bank of England, which was founded in 1694, interest rates on British gilts had always remained at 3%. There was 1 year in 1946 when they got down to 2.5%. This past summer, they got down to 0.5%.
Yeah, what's really interesting is that I don't think people really realize the, I call it a paradigm shift we've been going through, but the historic period we're in right now with the interest rates as low as they are, almost absurdly low if you look at some central banks where they're in negative territory. But we are going through a major change right now, and we will probably not go back to the way we were before.
Now, and a good example of, and we've used this several times, but it really drives home the point of the devaluation of money. Money does not buy the same goods and services or lifestyle today that it did 16 years ago. I mean, literally, if you had $1 million in the year 2000 and you, let's say you were retiring and you wanted to be very conservative, I could have put you in a 2-year treasury note. And on that $1 million, I could have got you $70,000 of income. You would have had something that was very secure. You would have had something that didn't fluctuate. If I was to put you in a 2-year treasury note today, John, instead of $70,000, you would only get $8,000 in interest. So not only does that $1 million not buy you the same goods and services, it also does not produce the income to buy you the same lifestyle. Another way of looking at it is if you wanted to have a monthly income of $3,000 a month and you wanted to keep it in something safe like a 2-year CD or a 2-year treasury note, you would need $4.5 million to produce $3,000 a month income. You would need $7.5 million to produce $5,000 a month income, and you would need $10.5 million to produce $7,000 a month. And for anybody living in New York City, Boston, Chicago, LA, California, San Francisco, $7,000 a month after taxes isn't a lot of money.
Yeah, so here we are then. We are in the new normal, but if you notice, unlike previous efforts to get people to get the consumer to spend and support the economy that way, central banks are the only ones who seem to be doing anything to keep things afloat, but it's not doing much in the active economy out there, but rather in the markets, and that's about it.
Well, it is. And the unfortunate thing is when central banks create money, the problem is that money can flow into different areas. It can flow into the economy, which is what central banks hope will happen. In other words, they create the money, banks make loans, people borrow money, and that expands the economy. Or it could just simply remain in cash with interest rates at zero or negative. That's unlikely. Or it can go into assets. And we saw that when Greenspan was expanding the money supply, lowering interest rates in the 90s, it created the technology bubble. In his response to the peso crisis in 94, the Asian crisis in 97, the long-term capital Russian debt default in 98, then once again in 99 with Y2K, and then once again in 2001 with the events of 9/11 and the recession. So we got the technology bubble. And as he lowered interest rates, he created the real estate bubble. We had a commodity bubble. And there are many people that believe that with interest rates at 5,000-year record lows, we're creating a bond market bubble. The problem is, because so much of this is resting on what the Fed is going to do. I remember they came out with QE1 and they said that was going to be over. Then they came out with QE2. That wasn't enough. Then they came out with QE3. Then they had the taper. Then they were going to raise rates. And the problem is, under the new normal, what we've seen in the financial markets are more frequent crises. And we've seen great rotations in the market itself between what we call risk on and risk off trade. And it is more frequent. It's, you know, we start out this year with the risk off trade. Then as we got close to summer with Brexit, we went to the risk off trade. Then the Bank of England and central banks flooded the markets with liquidity. And we went into the risk on trade, which is where we are today. The problem, as we see it, and we'll get into this when we talk about the next recession, is economic growth has failed to respond to monetary stimulus. Economic growth has probably been the weakest it's been in any economic expansion since World War II. We're averaging a little over 2%, and this year we'll be under 2%. We were at 1% levels in the first and second quarter, and we'll talk about why we got that 2.9% GDP print in the third quarter. We think that's more of an aberration having to do with exports and also with inventory. You typically see a spike in third quarter because what's happening, it's merchants, manufacturers are getting ahead of the Christmas in the holiday season, so everybody's bulking up on inventories, because what are stores going to be doing at Christmas? They're going to be bringing in new merchandise, and manufacturing firms are ramping up for the holiday season.
So here we are after a huge amount of money creation. We had, what, $10 trillion in debt and $4 trillion on the part of the Fed. Has it really accomplished anything in recovering the economy?
Well, I mean, if we go back to 2000, I mean, the money supply is up almost 600%. CPI, as officially measured by government, is up 35%. If you are attending a four-year college, college tuition is up 70%. Healthcare costs are up over 100%. They're going up next year 25%. Housing prices here in California are up 180%. The price of oil is up over 100%. Gold prices are up 400%, copper up 300%, corn up 100%, beef, or let's say hamburger, is up 112%, cable television is up 225%, and government expenditures are up 88%. And that's one of the problems that you have, is anytime government becomes a larger percentage of the economy, the more anemic the economic growth. And the best example I can give you is Europe and Japan today. So, John, we haven't accomplished much of anything other than creating asset bubbles.
Okay, so here we are. We've gone from the great moderation of the 1980s and the 1990s into now what has been called the new normal, as shaky and strange as it looks at time. And where we are headed in the future remains to be seen. And that's what we're going to discuss coming up next here on the Financial Sense News Hour.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Just recently, a massive attack launched by an Internet of Things botnet, also referred to as an IoT botnet, took place, and it took down a number of different sites. Many people are saying that this is just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to so-called IoT-based attacks. Joining us on the show today is Michael Momoso. He is the editor-in-chief at ThreatPost. Michael, would you mind walking our listeners through exactly what took place? I believe it was just a couple weeks ago, in terms of this attack, what it means, and what happened, really?
Sure. So there was a large distributed denial-of-service attack against basically one of the core infrastructure providers for the internet, a company in New Hampshire called Dyn. And basically attackers were using a collection of compromised IoT devices, primarily networked closed circuit TV cameras, IP enabled webcams, anything connected to the internet, to drive a bunch of garbage traffic at this infrastructure provider. And the reason it got a lot of attention was obviously it took down the services they provide, but they have a lot of high profile customers like Twitter, some Reddit sites, GitHub, Netflix, I believe was impacted. So a lot of these services on the East Coast of the United States were unreachable for different periods of time during the day.
So you refer to a denial of service attack. Just for our listeners that may not be familiar with that, let's discuss what that is, because as you kind of explained, it's basically a flood of traffic being directed somewhere. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of analogies you can use, but basically, if you've got a 5-gallon bucket and you're throwing 25 gallons of water into it, basically the bucket's not going to support that much water. The internet pipes that this company has, you know, only support so much traffic, and they were being overwhelmed by more traffic than they could handle. And, you know, just to be clear, we're talking about massive amounts of traffic per second. These companies are well prepared to defend themselves against these attacks, but when they're overwhelmed to this point, there's really nothing they can do at the time. They really have to kind of reassess the situation, buy more protection, redirect traffic, try to absorb it in some way that they can maintain services that they provide.
In the last segment, we talked about the new normal that we're in after having come out of the Great Moderation. And so in this new normal, now we have to look at the business cycle. And what we've been pointing out over the last few weeks here on the program is that the probabilities of a recession are very strong for 2017, just over the horizon. It's probably time to think about de-risking, because I think this storm is headed our way. Interestingly enough, Jim, I didn't hear it ever come up at all during the presidential campaigns. And in addition to that, whoever is in office will probably get blamed for it. So it's just the way it goes. Anyway, let's look about the de-risking issue here.
What we're going to do now is take a look at the business cycle, and we're going to take a look at what we call anticipatory indicators, because it's our contention that probably sometime in the fourth quarter, you're going to see the LEIs, the leading economic indicators, peak. And if it's typical of this business expansion, John, we see strong growth in the second and third quarter of the year, and then growth begins to weaken as you get into, let's say, the fourth quarter and the first quarter of the year. And the reason looking at the business cycle matters a lot is because if you look at bear markets that we've had in the past, they've all been associated with a recession. So, I mean, you can lay a graph of the S&P 500 and lay it over an economic graph of recessions, and you will see that the stock market begins to turn down ahead of the recession. The last one we had, the recession began in December of 2007. The stock market peaked in September of that year and began to head down. So that's why we think it's very important to take a look at what's happening in the economy, because it's going to tell you what might happen in the markets. Typically, what happens in a bear market, and I don't need to remind listeners, we've just gone through two of those in the last 15 years. The average return in a bear market is a negative 45%. And that's what happened in the last market, and it also happened in the bear market of 2000 to 2002. And the average duration of a bear market is 25 months. So if you think about the bear market, stocks peaked in March of 2000, and it wasn't until the summer of 2002 that we hit the trough of the bear market. If you take a look at the last bear market that started in 2007, it didn't end until March of 2009. So, you know, if you look at the macro environment associated with bear markets, there was only one period of time we had a flash crash during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, where we did not have a recession, but we had a 28% decline in stocks because things were pretty scary. Remember, that was back during the Cold War when there was a risk of a nuclear confrontation. The other bear market downturn where we didn't have a recession was the stock market crash of 1987, where stocks lost within basically a week 34%, including Black Monday, where stocks were down 23% and they were down 10% the Friday before that. So that's why we pay a lot of attention to the business cycle, because it tells you a lot of what may happen to the market. Because if you think about it, the economy goes into recession. What does that mean for a company? Well, a company means that they're getting less in sales. As they get less in sales, They make less in profits. As that happens, they begin to cut cost, which usually is employment. And what happens is the unemployment rate starts to go up. So you think of how this happens and basically transfers itself into the economy and how it impacts companies. So we like to take a look at business cycles because if you take a look at them, they've averaged from contraction, they're anywhere from 17 and a half months to 20 months. From expansions, these expansions last on average 40 months. We're already long in the tooth on this one. And so that's why we look at, you know, any kind of business cycle. There's the early recovery when you're coming out of recession. Think of, let's say, 2009 to 2012. Then you get into the mid part of the cycle, which was probably 2012 to 2015. Then you move into the late part of the cycle, which we think began last year and we're currently in now. And then eventually you get to a recession where the economy contracts. And so the things that you have to look at and what the market looks at, are things getting better or are they getting worse? At the margin, is growth accelerating, meaning things are getting better, or is growth decelerating, getting worse? And as we've pointed out, if you look at corporate profits, they've already peaked. That happened in 2014. If you look at economic growth, that already peaked. That happened in 2015. So we think we are in the latter stages of the business cycle, and we're seeing that in all kinds of signposts that we watch that we call anticipatory that are trying to give us a heads up on terms of where the LEIs are heading in the months in the year ahead.
Jim, when you're trying to predict where things are going, what are some of the, well, I guess, anticipatory things you monitor to determine the indicators that we should be watching? I know the jobs report came out on Friday. How well did that do?
They always beat expectations. There was only 161,000 jobs, hypothetical jobs, created. But even that has decelerated. Last year, we were hitting over 200,000 jobs a month. This year, and especially the last 6 months, that number has been considerably lower, which is where it is today. So if you take a look at, one of the things that we look at is what's going on in the employment market. And we take a look at the labor cycle. Typically, when you come out of a recession, the first thing that a company will do is they start adding temporary workers because they're not really sure, is the economy strengthening? Will it be durable? What's going on? And so companies will typically add temporary workers versus full-time employment. The second thing they begin to do is increase the hours worked. And then you also have to take a look at the economy. The goods producing, or what we call the manufacturing sector, which tends to be more cyclical, and the service sector of the economy. So the elephant in the room right now, John, is why we're paying so much attention, is the consumer. What is going on with consumer income and what is going on with consumer spending? And there's a leading indicator when it comes to employment, and that is employer profits. Employer profits usually peak before the peak in the wage cycle and employment. And you think about it logically. As profits peak with the company, as sales start to contract or go down, as profits start to contract, what do companies do? They start reacting. How do they react? They start to reduce the hours worked. The second thing they start to do is lay off temporary workers because that's the easiest. And so basically, we try to monitor profits, and then we also start looking very closely at what's going on in the labor market. And so if you take a look at the business cycle, corporate profit margins usually fall anywhere from 6 to 12 months prior to a recession. Wage inflation, however, continues to go up. In fact, the employment report that came out on Friday said that wage income is still going up. So if you follow what happens with the business, They have permanent employees. They have temporary employees. A permanent employee has steady income, health insurance, paid vacations, holidays, sick pay, a 401k plan. Contrast that to temporary workers. They have lower pay, no health care. They have no paid vacation, no paid holidays. They have very little job security. These are the employees that are first to let go when a company starts seeing its profits contract, which has been happening since the second quarter of 2014. So if you look at the labor cycle, you come out of a recession, companies start to add temporary workers as payrolls begin to increase. Then the next thing that happens is, as the economy continues to expand, full-time employees' payrolls begin to add. Then, as you get closer to a peak in the economy, temporary help workers begin to stall. And then, as you begin the downside heading towards a recession, what happens? Temporary workers begin to decline and are let go. And then eventually, full-time employee hours are cut. And then eventually, full-time employees are actually let go. So that's the cycle. So you get the stall of employment, which is what we've been talking about here on the program over the last couple months. We're already starting to see that on the payroll front. So the leading indicators of employment suggest that in the next couple months, we should start seeing a weakening in employment growth. And certainly we've seen that this year with the cutback in the amount of jobs created. We've gone from an average of 225,000 jobs created a month. We're now averaging somewhere between 150 and 175.
Is there any indication that companies are actually going in that direction in reaction to what's happening in the economy?
Yeah, I mean, it just anecdotal evidence, but I mean, Manitowoc is going through a current cost-cutting cycle. Recently, Harley-Davidson is reporting that they're laying off their casual workers, quote, temporary workers. ING is going to cut 7,000 jobs. Ford last week announced that it is idling four plants because they think that we've reached a peak in production. And we're also seeing full-time employee work week is starting to slow as the hours are starting to cut back. In fact, there was an article accusing Starbucks of slashing employee work hours amid cost cutting. So we're seeing that. And the thing that we monitor is there's two sides of the economy. The durable goods side, or what we call the manufacturing side, is already moving towards a recession. And then we also look at the service side, which tends to be non-cyclical. The goods producing employment that we're starting to see is non-payroll servicing, and the goods department is already close to heading to negative territory, where the service sector is also starting to roll over, but it's still going at a much stronger pace in most of the jobs. So basically, we're already starting to see this pullback in employment and temporary workers, job hires, job creations. So we're seeing that trend.
Yeah, but the Fed at the same time, Jim, is keeping money loose. So what's going on in terms of the Fed's side of the cycle?
Well, we're also following to credit, because credit also drives the economy. And we've seen this in Fed surveys of banks. Banks are starting to tighten standards for commercial and industrial loans, and that correlates very closely with profit margins. So we're seeing a tightening of credit by the banks, and we're seeing a fall in the drop of corporate margins. The other thing that we're seeing is non-farm payrolls also correlate with what banks are doing in credit. So you can take a look at this drop in the number of jobs created along with the tightening of the bank cycle, and they line up back to back. So if you think about it, how this all works is as income begins to slow down, let's say the hours are cut back, temporary workers are cut back, what does that do? It slows down discretionary spending, which is why we're watching retail sales, and we're also watching trucking. So if you cut back on spending, and that means you're not buying stuff in the stores, it means trucks aren't transporting the stuff. So we've seen a drop in consumer income growth. It's beginning to slow down. We're also seeing a drop in discretionary spending. I don't care if you're monitoring jewelry, casino gambling, dining out, clothing spending, cosmetics, perfume. And one of the indicators we like to look at, it's one of the first areas that's cut out, is dining out is almost in negative territory. We've talked about the NRA Restaurant Performance Index is just about to dip into negative territory. When it starts to decline, that gives you kind of a heads up in terms of what is coming. So we're seeing slowing income growth, which is leading to number two, slowing consumption, which is leading to number three, less hauling of goods by trucking. So, John, these are anticipatory, and the economy is still growing. We got the pop of GDP last week, but we think that's a temporary pop.
Well, Jim, sailors always watch barometers. So do pilots. And when the barometer's falling, just like the New England fisherman's glass would tell you, that may be storms a-coming. So is it time to duck and run for cover?
Well, I mean, it's definitely time to get defensive. Several people that we follow, and we've had them on our show, Dave Rosenberg recently was interviewed, and he says, I'm not saying now is the time to head to a storm cellar, but I am saying it's time, at the very least, to start carrying an umbrella with you. In other words, get defensive. And Mohammed Al-Aryan, interviewed on Bloomberg recently, he said the probabilities are now starting to tip in the likelihood of a bad outlook. They're starting to tip in favor of low growth, a giving away to periods of recession. This is a better time to be a seller of stocks than a buyer. So where are we starting to see this in some of the divergences that some of our technicians have reported? And I think you'll start to see this translate into what does well in the stock market, which would confirm this.
Well, normally in recessions, stocks don't do too well, but there's a process. And you and I have done this. I remember years ago we did this, talked about the same thing. As you're rolling down into it, there's a process for managing your investments in such a way as to not be affected by it.
Well, I mean, if you take a look at the mid-cycle to near the end, in the mid-cycle of an economic recovery, what does well? Stocks. I mean, think of the stock market 2012 through, let's say, 2014. Another asset class that does well is high-yield junk bonds. Commodities do well, and investment-grade bonds. As you get to the latter cycle, it begins to reverse. Stocks do less well. High-yield bonds don't do as well because the risk of a recession, what would happen is you would see greater defaults in the junk bond market. What does well is in the latter part of the cycle as you hit the peak are commodities. And then finally, you start to see higher quality assets do well like sovereign bonds or, let's say, high-grade corporates because what happens is you're going into a de-risk category. So areas that do well in the late business cycle are material stocks, consumer staples, healthcare, and energy, which we're seeing right now. What does well as you get closer to a recession are consumer staples, things like healthcare, things like telecom and utilities because you want to be invested in sectors that are less immune to the economy.
So here we are approaching a point where we think that there's probably going to be a pretty heavy recession somewhere by 2017, somewhere in the middle of it probably. If you're going to have to make that case to investors and pitch them the idea of getting defensive, how would you do that?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at the average economic expansion, John, this is already getting late in the tooth, and we're not seeing the kind of things that you would see on an expanding economy. More hiring, more temps, more jobs being added, retail sales, all those kind of things are starting to point. And one of the things that we do is we have our own recession indicator, and it is getting close to 20. And anytime it gets close to 20 and goes over it, that is a warning sign to us that we get repaired. Now, we did have a false signal. If we went back to 2011, we got to 20, and you got to remember what was happening that year. We had Fukushima, the Arab Spring, the debt ceiling debate, the downgrading of U.S. debt, the pig crisis in Europe, and, you know, all the LEIs were rolling over, so it did look like we were heading into a recession. But then again, we got monetary stimulus, and we had a nice booming cycle from 2012 to 2014. So our recession indicator is now approaching close to 20. And the other thing that we're looking at is market valuations, because as we pointed out, when central banks create money, it goes into one of three areas. It can go into the economy, cash, or it can go into markets. And if we look at the market valuations in terms of the mean average for the stock market, we're at roughly about 78% over valuation, which was just about where we were during the Great Depression. So the valuation on stocks are at higher levels versus, let's say, where they were back in 2010 or after the financial crisis. And so, you know, as you take a look at all these things as a backdrop, what do we have? We have economic indicators are starting to weaken. Commodity prices spike, which is what you see towards the end of the cycle. Just think of oil prices today. An aggressive Fed. Well, the Fed's not aggressive, but let's put it this way. They're not lowering rates. They're gearing towards raising rates with a 70% probability. They raise interest rates in December. And the next thing you have is extreme valuations. Well, we're certainly at very high valuations in the market. So when you add it all up, it sounds like, John, you know, once again, we're making the case. It's time to get defensive.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Joining us on the show today is Carl Wright from TrapX, and TrapX provides cybersecurity solutions using deception. And so this is sort of a new arena, something that many of you have not heard about, and you're going to learn some really interesting things in terms of this new innovation and what's being used to try to fight cyber attackers. Carl, tell us a little bit about your company and this idea of fighting cybercrime using deception.
Right. Well, first of all, thank you, Chris, for having me on the show. And we're excited to talk about this new category of technology called deception technologies. And I think that you and your audience are very aware that the number of cyber attacks have been escalating over the last few years. And we really don't see the number of breaches that enterprise organizations are dealing with diminish over the next 5 years. And so that begs the question, you know, as people deploy security technologies in a stack of capabilities, where's the gap and what do they need to do to get better situational awareness and visibility of when these attackers are being successful? And so quite succinctly, what TrapX does is we are a deception technology vendor that commingles fake assets with real assets at a massive level within the computing environment of these enterprise organizations. And when adversaries penetrate successfully some aspect of the enterprise architecture and they move laterally, invariably they will run in and interact with are fake assets. And the word asset's important because it's not just computer operating systems and web services and databases. We create deception emulations of routers and switches and storage and voice over IP architectures, IoT devices. And then in the case of today's discussion, entire Swift architectures that we will create emulations of to fool the attackers.
So we say that we are in the new normal. Well, that's nice to know. It's nice to know you're in the middle of a hurricane. The question is how you navigate in the middle of some type of weather like that, so to speak. It's very difficult to predict with any kind of high degree of accuracy the timing and the nature of a recession. So the question that's always in people's minds, how long should I stay in? When should I get out? When should I be defensive? How do you navigate in this type of an ocean of the new normal?
Well, you know, it's been called the new normal. We think it's going to resemble what we call the yo-yo years as defined by ECRI and very much reflect what we saw after World War II when we saw these huge spikes in economic growth on the upside and the downside, and recessions were more frequent, where basically they would last, a business cycle would last 3 to 5 years, not 6 or 7 years or 10 years as we did in the Great Moderation, because we have a number of things going on. We've just come out of a financial crisis that was basically caused by excessive amount of debt and speculation. And economists assume at some point that when this is over, we'll have economic growth and it'll be normal again. The problem is, John, there isn't any evidence of that. Number one, we think we're more likely to see more frequent recessions, very much like we did between the 50s and 60s and 70s. The other pattern that we have seen over the last 16 years is the rate of GDP growth is falling. Now, there's a number of reasons for that. But number one, more debt. Number two, higher taxes. Number three, higher regulation. Number four, government is becoming a larger segment of the U.S. economy. And we're also seeing lower participation in the job front and fewer business formations. And remember, small businesses are the engine of growth in this economy. Think of all the companies that start out. I don't care if it's Twitter, Facebook, Google, all these companies that have become great innovators and created jobs. We're seeing less of that in this economic recovery. And there's only two ways that you can have an expansive economic recovery. And that is have a higher rate of growth, economic growth, which means there's the less probability of having a recession. Think of the 1980s and the 1990s when we went 10 years between one recession to the next. And I just don't see anything like that out there. And if you think about how the world works today, the U.S. economy is still the biggest game on the block. We're almost 25% of world GDP. Now, if you take a look at the U.S. economy, 70% of it is dominated by consumption. So when U.S. consumers begin to cut back on purchases, that has a ripple effect across the world. Because what does that mean? It means when we cut back, we're buying less stuff, which means we're importing less stuff, which means the stuff starts to pile up in warehouses. Companies start to cut back on production, as we're seeing now. As I mentioned, Ford idling four plants now, and you're going to see more of that. Harley Davidson cutting its temporary workers. And as companies produce less stuff, that means they're using less raw materials. So the raw material producing countries in the world like Australia, Latin America, Brazil, that are heavily dependent on commodity exports, they get impacted. And then that begins to translate into what we see in world trade. And we're seeing a shift. But if you take a look at since the beginning of the new millennium, the trend growth in employment, the more cyclical nature of our recoveries, and the rate of economic growth has been slowing, and that includes this recent recovery, where the average growth rate has barely made it over 2%. And ever since the recovery began, the Fed and everybody else and economists have been talking about 3%. We may reach a 3% growth rate in a quarter, but we've never achieved it on an annual basis.
You know, there's a fundamental principle here. As government becomes larger and a larger share of the economy, we see that economic growth tends to slow. Now, the real question is how much larger it's going to become, because we have it taking over more and more a share of social programs and other things related to that, such as Obamacare. And it would seem like the growth of government will continue, which means a greater lug down on the economy.
Well, I mean, it is. I mean, you take a look at, and this has always amazed me in this political election where both candidates are promising all this free stuff. Hillary, free college, free medical, expansion of Medicare. 68% of the government's budget is now on automatic pilot. That's Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and interest on the debt, which leaves only 32% for defense spending, non-defense spending, and other stuff. Well, you have the rate of growth, the mandatory spending, is now growing at 6 to 7% a year. So, you know, as that begins to expand, and you notice, John, nothing, I don't care if it's Social Security, Medicare, none of the entitlements or deficit of spending has been addressed in this political campaign. So you got a lot of promises that are being made out there, but government is increasing in its size and will be increasing in its size going forward because, as I mentioned, almost 70% of government spending is now on automatic pilot.
Yes, but the things, Jim, that actually produced the Great Moderation or allowed it to exist no longer do exist. We no longer have low taxation rates. We've got more debt. If you look at the central banks, we're down to zero or negative interest rates in some cases. There's all kinds of structural problems, whether we look at, well, let's go to Europe. I mean, that's pretty obvious, but also Japan, China, These things are non-existent now in this environment.
And that's one reason why we think we're going from, we've transitioned from the great moderation to the new normal. And we think going forward, we're transitioning to what we call the yo-yo years, where the economic cycles will be shorter in their duration. They will be more volatile. We're going to be more cyclical. And a good example of that is just take a look at the Japanese economy since the 1990s. I mean, today, Japan's stock market has not come even close to where it was in 1989. When it peaked. Now, there have been several bull markets in the Nikkei over the years that have averaged anywhere from 45 to 60%. But John, the Nikkei is still in a lower level of valuation in terms of where the market is to where it was almost 26 years ago. The other thing that we think we're going to see, and we've seen it throughout this recovery, is we're going to see more of what we call the ro-ro trade, or the risk on or the risk off. I mean, we've already had the risk off trade at the beginning of the year. Then we went to the risk on trade after the change in central bank sentiment. Then we went to the risk off trade ahead of Brexit. Then we went to the risk on trade after Brexit. And I think by the time we get to the end of the year, and especially with the possible Fed rate hike in December, we'll be going back to the risk off trade at the end of the year and heading into the new year. And especially if we're correct in terms of where this economy is peaking on the economic front.
Yeah, we use that term quite a bit, by the way, risk on, risk off. Describe once again what that means, especially from an investment standpoint.
If you think of risk off, you think of things that are safer, more conservative in nature, things like cash, short-term bonds, consumer staples, telecom, utilities, short-term treasuries, gold. These are the things that hold up well when everybody's sort of in that fearful mode or you're heading in a possible recession. The risk on trade is junk bonds, small cap stocks, cyclical stocks, emerging markets. That's when people are more aggressive in their thinking. And if you take a look at some of the markets, the way they've worked out this year, small cap stocks from the NASDAQ to the Russell 2000 were doing very well in the risk on trade. As you move closer to the risk off, think of utilities, telecom stocks. I mean, so if you take a look at the returns in the market this year, some of the higher returns have been in the S&P Mid-Cap 400, the S&P Small-Cap 500, the Russell 2000. This is where we've seen some of the greatest performance, although the best performing sector this year by far has been gold stocks, with the price of gold hitting a bottom. You know, if you take a look at the Philly Fed index, the GDX index, gold stocks are up almost 100% this year. So that's the kind of thing that you see when you go to a risk on or versus the risk off trade.
So as we try to sum all of this up, where do we stand right now?
If you take a look at where we are, this economic recovery is getting long in the tooth. It's already exceeded the average duration in terms of amount of months. So basically, this economy is living on borrowed time. As we pointed out here so many times, corporate profits have peaked in the second quarter 2014. Third quarter profits of this year are showing this will be the sixth consecutive quarter of declining profits. If you take a look at the economic numbers, I don't care if you look at the ISM, the LEIs, or even GDP growth rates, that peaked in the second quarter of 2015. Employment in terms of job creation peaked in the fourth quarter of 2015. So if we look at the business cycle, John, we're already in the late stage of the business cycle. And, you know, whether it'll last into the first part of next year, and especially, we don't know what the impact is going to be if the Fed raises interest rates in December. Several of our technicians have said on this program that we can remain in the risk on trade until we reach that period of time when the Fed raises interest rates, which can change the whole margin. We're watching credit spreads to see what's happening. We're watching credit default swaps to see if we're going to repeat the same pattern that we had going into the end of the year that we did last year when the Fed was telling us, yep, we're going to raise, which they finally did in December. And of course, everybody knows what happened in the first part of the year.
So from your perspective, as I see it, if we list out the timeline here, corporate earnings peaked in 2014. The economy peaked last year. That's 2015. Job growth peaked in 2015. and we're much more likely now to head into a recession. But we live in a global economy. Everybody's affected by the same influences. What will be the impact?
Number one, I think the financial impact is going to be greater overseas. We're following three areas. Europe, we've got a vote coming up in December with Italy. That may be the next country to leave the euro. We're watching China, which is decelerating in its economic growth. They've got a financial bubble. Chinese debt is up fourfold since the 2008 crisis. We're also watching Japan, where nothing seems to be working. So I think, John, it's going to be more pronounced. If we have a recession here in the U.S., the impact is more likely to be greater overseas, which is why we still like staying in our backyard. And if you think about it, the way recessions and the way bear markets develop, I mean, the time to buy is when things are negative. The leading economic indicators are down. The stock market is down. Commodity prices are down. Sentiment is negative. You compare that to where we are today. The PMIs are up. Stock market is up. Oil prices are up. Emerging market is up. Sentiment is still bullish. I mean, that's typically what you see towards the peak of a cycle, not at the trough of a cycle. And that's why I think it's time to start getting defensive. Just as Dave Rosenberg said, you know, maybe the barometer hasn't dropped and a storm is not upon our doorstep, but it's definitely time to start carrying around an umbrella.
So as I carry my ready umbrella with me, as we look at the weeks to come here, we're coming up close to Thanksgiving holiday and the end of the year, as a matter of fact. What are we looking forward to?
You know, we'll be winding down corporate earnings here in the next couple of weeks. And like I said, I think this will be the sixth consecutive quarter of declining earnings. And the market's going to be anticipating, John. The big event will be, of course, next Tuesday, we'll have election. And finally, silly season will be over. And I think you're going to see some jockeying around in the markets, depending on who wins. You know, you might see position changing into different sector rotations that would do better under a Clinton presidency versus a Trump. So you might see a little bit more volatility coming out of the election. But the big event next week, we'll be talking about it next Friday, is the results of the election. Who will be our next commander and president of the United States? What will happen to the makeup of Congress will determine whether we have a divided Congress and a balance and check upon the presidency. So that will be a big event. And then, of course, we're going to be looking at Black Friday, the start of the Christmas retail season, for signs of weakness or strength in retail spending. And then, of course, leading into the end of the year, we're going to be talking about December. Will they or will they not? Will the Fed finally raise interest rates? Right now, futures market pegs it at a 70% probability, which is pretty high. So unless we just get some really dramatic slowdown in economic numbers that would give the Fed pause, or some kind of crisis overseas, let's say with Italy or something like that, it looks like the Fed is likely to go ahead in December. So those are the things we're going to be watching. And we'll also be looking at what companies are saying about the fourth quarter, especially as we get into the months of December. So lots of stuff to talk about: the elections, the Fed meeting, and Christmas. All of that coming up in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. the investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.